Open source intelligence has flourished in recent years. It seems like there are news stories nearly every week on how OSINT is being used to combat disinformation, and track injustice, defeat cybercriminals, and even save lives. The domains of intelligence, technology, and conflict have never been so connected, and hiding amongst all those connections are the stories that shape this world. Each episode of this podcast will introduce a new guest who has a unique tale to tell. We will explore disinformation, human rights cases, gripping personal narratives, cybersecurity threats, and run deep investigations into global conflicts. And all through accounts told by the practitioners fighting in the trenches who brought these events into the light. My name is MJ Benias, and for about a decade, I have been a researcher, a journalist, and an analyst who has used OSINT to tell stories. But now, here, with this podcast, I want to understand how intelligence and security and OSINT all influence and shape our world. And the best way to understand anything, especially something so murky and hidden, is to tell the stories that shape it. This is Cloak and Dagger, a podcast about OSINT, technology, and global conflict. I'm MJ Benias. This podcast is powered by Sapper Labs Group. For more, visit www.sapperlabs.com.
To me, that was the realization. So we started to follow this guy and eventually found out, well, he wasn't alone. He had friends that he was basically coaching. And you know, they did some training camps. They had some plans. But by the time June rolled around and they were arrested, there was 18 people arrested. And they had planned to explode 3 1-ton fertilizer bombs in downtown Toronto.
This is my buddy, Phil Gursky. He's definitely going to hate me for saying this, but he's kind of one of those old dog spies. He's retired now, but he has been around the block so many times that the guy can suss anyone out pretty quick.
So I spent a little more than 32 years in the Canadian intelligence community.
Phil's one of those guys who's been using various forms of intelligence, including OSINT, for decades. And since he's been playing the game for so long, he's definitely seen a lot.
I started out, 40 years ago almost, as a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed 22-year-old at Communications Security Establishment, or CSE, which is Canada Signals Intelligence Organization. Not knowing SIGINT from a hole in the ground when I began, in those days, CSE was not acknowledged to exist by the Canadian government, so it was a whole new world for me.
Phil spent about 17 years at CSE, specializing as an analyst with a focus on the Middle East and Asia. He has a gift for languages and can speak about 10 of them. His knack for Arabic and Farsi and Persian got him pretty much established as the go-to guy for intel analysis.
So I did that for a bit, and then, you know, I kind of got to my mid-career point. The only way to get ahead was to become a manager. I tried it, didn't like it. It wasn't sort of in my wheelhouse. And so CSIS came a calling, and I'd worked very closely with CSIS way back to the very beginning in 84, so they all knew who I was.
For all you non-Canadians, and frankly, probably some Canadians, CSIS is the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. It's Canada's big intelligence gathering agency, kind of like the CIA in the United States, but with a few differences.
So they brought me in as a strategic analyst, originally look at Iran, my specialization being a Farsi linguist and that kind of stuff. But then 9/11 happened.
We believe that a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center in New York. That happened within the last few moments. No details at this stage as to what sort of plane it is. It could well be.
Phil became a hot commodity after the attacks on September 11th.
And I morphed into a counterterrorism analyst. My Arabic obviously helped. My Middle Eastern background in terms of history helped. So I became CSIS's specialist in Islamist-inspired radicalization and terrorism in Canada. Worked on hundreds of cases in the 2000s and 2010s.
I just need to pause here. I mean, 9/11, that event shattered a half century of security and peace in this country and in North America and the West. I mean, I remember before 9/11 and sitting in class and thinking that I lived on this super safe continent and in a super safe country and that all that bad stuff was really far away. And the next morning, I remember driving to school, all that bad stuff had somehow come crashing into buildings full of people. And listening on the radio, all of a sudden, I realized that where I lived wasn't so safe anymore.
So in the aftermath of 9/11, of course, everybody was worried about when's the next, you know, not necessarily when's the next plane going to hit a building, but when's the next plot going to happen? And we here in Canada were naive. We knew that it was probably a matter of time before we realized this was going to take place in our country. I think for me, my come to Jesus moment, which is a bizarrely mixed metaphor, is we came across a guy in Toronto who was online spouting the usual jihadi shit. And he chose to call himself C4 Explosive. Now, lesson out there for all aspiring terrorists. Don't call yourself C4 Explosive online. You're going to get someone's attention.
Okay, Phil is a bit of a rebellious raconteur. So let's backtrack a bit here. It's late 2004, early 2005. And as Phil tells it, some internet chatter catches the attention of CSIS. Some guy posting under the username C4 Explosive is on a few forums, posting about the war in Afghanistan, making threatening statements against the West, saying Canada will be attacked. Now, post 9/11, there was a lot of this kind of stuff online.
That to me was like, oh, wow. Okay, I think this guy is the biggest idiot in the world. And by the way, the vast majority of people who post stuff online are the biggest idiots in the world. And one thing that puzzles me is this, okay, you know, there's so much, you know, hate and extremism online. Yeah, there is. But the vast majority of it goes nowhere because the people who post that kind of stuff are idiots. They're incompetent. They have no capability. They have no intent. They just like to spread garbage online. That's the challenge, I think, in the OSINT world, as I said earlier, to try to winnow out the pieces that mean something from the vast majority of stuff that's absolute shite and that you can ignore.
So Phil and the other counterterrorism analysts need to essentially make a judgment call. Is this guy legitimately dangerous? Yeah, the stuff he's saying is definitely violent and he is definitely radicalized, but having radical beliefs is different than acting on them. But this guy kept popping up on their radar, posts kept showing up, and a clear picture began to form that C4 Explosive was up to something beyond just posting anti-Western rhetoric.
So we started to follow this guy and eventually found out, well, he wasn't alone. He had friends that he was basically coaching. And you know, they did some training camps.
Basically, using the posts and running some traces, they were able to figure out that this group was preparing for something. As months went on, authorities figured out they were operating a training camp outside of Toronto. The plan was twofold. First, they wanted to grow their numbers and essentially radicalize as many people as they could. And as it turned out, a good handful of their membership were teenagers, like 16-year-old boys. And the second part of the plan was an attack. So Canada's Federal Police, the RCMP, and CSIS, with the help of some undercover informants and police officers, they basically set up a sting operation. According to reports, the terrorist group was plotting to detonate multiple bombs. They had everything they needed, except one key ingredient.
3 tons of fertilizer.
Ammonium nitrate, to be precise.
You know what a ton of fertilizer bomb looks like? Google it. It ain't pretty.
This was the same stuff used by Timothy McVeigh back in 1995 when he blew up a government building in Oklahoma City.
A massive car bomb exploded outside of a large federal building in downtown Oklahoma City, shattering that building, killing children, killing federal employees, military men, and civilians.
He killed 168 people, including 6 kids, and injured hundreds more.
And they had planned to explode 3 1-ton fertilizer bombs in downtown Toronto.
One target was Toronto's Stock Exchange. Another was a Canadian military base and Phil's place of work, the Toronto CSIS office. So using the informants and some undercover operatives, Phil and the team set up a sting operation offering this group exactly what they wanted. A quiet, under-the-radar shipment of ammonium nitrate. Now, little did the buyers know that the authorities actually swapped the fertilizer out with a harmless substance. But anyway, the group buys the 3 tons of fertilizer, and that is when the trap closes. There's a massive sweep across Ontario of arrests of every member of the group.
By the time June rolled around and they were arrested, there was 18 people arrested. That to me was like, wow. And these guys were all Toronto, either born and bred or, you know, immigrated as children. These were Canadians. These were your neighbors. And they had completely come up with this idea, which they borrowed from terrorist groups abroad, that it was not just okay to carry out an act in Canada, but it was obligatory to do so. They had no choice but to do so. And at one point, they even called themselves Al-Qaeda in Canada. So for my, you know, as an analyst, I'm thinking, okay, you know, when's this shoe going to drop? That was the shoe that didn't drop because we interdicted them before they acted. The RCMP arrested them in June of 2006. And a lot of them got jail time. Some were acquitted. Some got time served. That's Canadian justice. That's a whole other podcast on the inadequacies of Canadian justice when it comes to terrorism. But I think that for me as an analyst, this was a proof of concept that everything that I've been talking about in terms of radicalization, the ideology, the religious motifs they were using, how it happened, what it looked like, was coming to bear. And it was probably it was about time because we'd heard our allies talking about this. And, you know, there are people in Canada saying, well, we're different here. We don't have the problems other countries have. Well, we do. Bottom line is it can happen here. It has happened here.
The Toronto 18 case, as it has come to be known, came with a lot of controversy. There were allegations that the undercover officers and the informants used methods of entrapment and even provoked these young men to engage in a terrorist plot. However, the presiding judge ruled that this was not the case. To be frank, there is still a lot of debate about this case. But Canada is a democracy, and in a democracy, that's allowed. Oversight, criticism, appeals. Regardless, for Canadians, this incident reminded us, briefly, that anyone, including some young men who grew up in Toronto, can go from spouting vitriol online to buying 3 tons of fertilizer to kill innocent people. Anyway, Phil did another 10 years, and a couple hundred cases later, he retired in 2015.
My retirement lasted 16 days and 10 minutes. I got snapped up by the Ontario Provincial Police's anti-terrorism section to help them with their investigations for a bit. Have written 6 books on terrorism since 2015, so almost a book a year. And done some other work for some private corporations. And the last couple of years, I've been involved with the University of Ottawa's Professional Development Institute in National Security.
I could let Phil keep going, but I won't. The guy just won't stop working. He does tons of media. He does presentations around the world on the topic of terrorism and radicalization. He teaches. He consults. He owns his own company called Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting. I think he's one of those I can rest when I'm dead kind of guys. But for Phil, retirement doesn't absolve you of your duty. And for his beloved country of Canada, he can still see those threats hiding in the shadowy corners, whether it's coming from Russia, China, or even radicalized movements around the globe.
There's this assumption out there, that I'm not sure where it comes from, that Islamist terrorism is dead. Donald Trump, sorry to bring his name up, declared back in 2019 that ISIS was dead. It was totally defeated. And that, like in most things, Trump said it was wrong. ISIS is still very strong. They're carrying out daily attacks in Syria and Iraq. They've got at least a dozen or more provinces around the world that are very strong. In West Africa, they've killed tens of thousands. They've got a cell in Mozambique. They've got a cell in Yemen. They've got a cell in India. They've got a cell in Afghanistan. And they're by far responsible for the vast majority of attacks. So if you do what I said before and just educate yourself on what's happening from an OSINT perspective. So I can recommend 20 sites in Asia, Middle East that will tell you on a daily basis who killed who. And it tends to be the ISISs and the Al-Qaedas are still around. Bin Laden's death didn't mean the end of Al-Qaeda. Al-Zawahiri's death didn't mean the end of Al-Qaeda. There's a misconception that terrorism dies. It doesn't die. If the causes are still valid, you're going to find someone who's going to be behind the cause. Secondly, ever since 2017 or so in Canada, there's been this notion that here in Canada, it's not as important. Despite the fact we had two lethal attacks in 2014 in October, we had serious attacks that didn't result in deaths in 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018. We just had a knifing in Surrey, BC last week by an ISIS wannabe, one person seriously injured. But the Canadian public, and more dangerously, the Canadian government has decided this is yesterday's threat.
That is just always the way it is, though, right? The sort of flavor of the month. But also, we got to look at what Canada's dealing with. I mean, Russia invaded Ukraine, and Canada is getting pelted constantly with cyber attacks and social engineering campaigns to manipulate facts. Libertarian extremist militias, the Boogaloo Boys, Proud Boys, white supremacists, COVID-19 conspiracy theorists, ultra-nationalist religious movements. I mean, Canada even has a lady who says she is the true queen and has ordered her followers to try and arrest police officers for crimes committed against her. Oh, and don't forget Russian mercenary groups operating in Africa, impeding Canadian and Western diplomacy there, and the Chinese government.
Well, I woke up to an explosive report in the Globe and Mail this morning, reporting that CSIS documents viewed by the newspaper reveal China's strategy to influence the 2021 election. Beijing wanted the Liberals to be elected, but only to a minority mandate. And according to the documents, China viewed the Conservatives as too harsh on China and used disinformation campaigns against them.
If you had to say, you know, your greatest concern right now, what is your, like, what's your biggest anxiety?
The Canadian government's lack of appreciation for good information. I don't think they get it. And now I more narrowly paint that as a lack of intelligence culture, but I think it goes beyond that. I think they've got their own sources, many of which they ignore. And I think the Chinese interference issue was an absolute classic example.
Yeah, I guess we're going to have to get into this one. And really, it's probably one of the most divisive issues in Canadian politics and intelligence right now. And it is, frankly, one hell of a mess.
The Globe and Mail's Stephen Chase and Bob Fyfe broke the story, and Stephen Chase joins me now live in the studio. So, Stephen, great story, bombshell story today. Tell us broadly what you uncovered here.
What we've uncovered is evidence that the Chinese state, the Chinese government, wanted to affect the outcome of the 2021 election.
And it all began when someone with a security clearance leaked a highly sensitive report to the Canadian press.
About 2 months ago, the Globe and Mail came out with this barnstorm of a story of an actual leaked CSIS report, and I recognize it from day one because it's the kind of reports I used to write on Islamist terrorism. Had the right header, had the right formatting. This was a report that went up to the government saying, we have solid intelligence suggesting the Chinese government interfered in at least the 2019 and 2021 elections. When that hit, it was like, oh my God, oh my God. Yeah, those are saying, yeah, well, we've been telling you this for 30 years.
Okay, so in February, the Globe and Mail, that's like Canada's New York Times, runs this crazy story. One of their journalists gets this shadowy tip from a source with access to classified material. And the details are pretty murky, but this anonymous source hands over a CSIS report that basically says the Chinese government took multiple steps to influence Canadians and to ensure that the Liberal Party would secure a minority government in 2019 and in the 2021 elections. Now, I need to say that this is one spicy topic, and there is significant debate around whether these influence operations actually worked, and whether they actually did influence Canadians to vote a certain way, but the report contains a lot of details, and I have to be honest, for folks in the intelligence world, it's no secret that the Chinese government is a big player in foreign interference in Canada and around the globe.
As a nation of immigrants with large diasporas, the concern was is that certain countries would identify individuals in those diasporas to do their bidding that could be influenced. Maybe, you know, tug at their heartstrings. You're really a Chinese citizen, not a Canadian one. This is where your heart and soul lie. Or coercion. Yeah, you're here living the life of Riley here in BC. Guess what? You've got relatives back in Harbin. And if you don't pony up, guess what happens to your relatives, right? They're going to be in a very, very sorry state. So we've had both of that happen. And so when there's mandates, CSIS have been investigating this for the better part of 40 years, since 1984. It's been a priority investigation since day one. Recall that CSIS began in the Cold War. Back in the early 80s, there was very little counterterrorism because that was not the soup of the day. It was all about the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact. My career started during the Cold War. It showed no signs of ebbing back then. We were surprised when it ended as soon as it did in 89 and 91. As a consequence, you've got an organization that's been monitoring this for four decades. So CSIS's mandate is to investigate, to collect, to process, to analyze, and to advise. So the last part is where they take all this intelligence, this raw intelligence, you go through it, you corroborate it, you assess it, you package it up, you put a bow on it, and you send it downtown saying, here's what we know about X, Y, or Z.
Right. We know this, right? This is how all intelligence gathering works. Even in the OSINT world or in the corporate security world or whatever, we all know you have to collect all of this raw data and then you analyze it. And you basically provide, at the end of it all, an assessment based upon levels of confidence. And that can range. Sometimes there is only enough data to provide a belief of what may happen, a kind of low-level best guess. Or what could you think will happen? Like, it probably will, but you're not 100%. And sometimes you have enough data and corroboration to let you say, yeah, this will happen, we know what's going on.
You can't force people to read it. You can send it to them, but you can't force them to read it. What we found is that the messages, especially on the People's Republic of China, were seen as inconvenient. We're trying to build our relationship with China. We're trying to, expand our trade relationship with China. We saw China as the golden calf. We're going to make a shit ton of money from China and we're going to become good friends, blah, 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 blah. And so all this intelligence say, well, yeah, I understand that, but this is what China's doing on our soil through the embassies, through the consulates, more recently through these police stations they've created in Canada, which are not, are illegal, monitoring Chinese population, putting pressure on them. And all this information is going into the intelligence bucket and it's been provided, and yet it doesn't seem to be getting any reaction.
A quick pause here regarding Phil's mention of Chinese police stations operating in Canada. These are secretly and very illegally set up by the Chinese government in countries around the world, some under the guise of support services. They operate very much in the shadows and basically use intimidation and coercion to influence members of the Chinese diaspora. There have been tons of reports and allegations regarding these secret police units all over the world, and the Chinese government has always denied that they exist. In mid-April of 2023, the FBI arrested two men in New York City who were allegedly agents working in one of these stations. Anyway, back to Phil.
And then we have, last two elections in 2019, 2021, very close elections, by the way, both resulted in minority liberal governments. And it turns out that CSIS was aware that the Chinese government was very much in favor of a Trudeau minority government because they felt they could work with it. They were absolutely apoplectic about having a conservative government because they realized conservatives were very anti-China. They didn't want that to take place. What they did, therefore, is they put measures in place to try to influence the election. What that influence took the form of, probably cash payouts, probably putting the bug in people's ear. Next time you're in the community, talk about, how bad the conservatives are, how good the liberals are. It was essentially influence peddling amongst the Chinese Canadian community. And 11 ridings in particular were noted as where this was really, really bad. It's impossible to measure the consequence of that meddling. As I said earlier, we don't know why, Phil Gursky voted the way he did. Well, first of all, you don't know how I voted unless I tell you, because it's secret. That's the whole point of an election. And it was noted that, but there was a heavy campaign to try and at least push the bar in these 11 ridings. Did it result in a Trudeau minority? I have no idea. Did it result in changes to those riding results? I have no idea. Doesn't matter. The fact is that CSIS demonstrated that, yes, they had done this. It was deliberate. This wasn't a random program. This was carefully planned, carefully considered, carefully carried out. Even then, this information that had been passed up didn't have any consequence. No one seemed to care. Nobody thought, hey, maybe we should talk to the Chinese about this. Maybe we should expel some diplomats. Nothing happened. And as a consequence, this isn't a surprise to anybody. It was a surprise to Canadians, I imagine. Because no one had been talking about it, and governments hadn't been talking about it.
So this intelligence report goes public via the Globe and Mail, and it blows up. Now, in all fairness, a quick Google search brings up a lot of media coverage on this topic from well before the leak. And even before 2019, you can find articles and white papers on China's interference in Canadian politics going back for a while, actually. Take that for what it's worth. Regardless, here we are. In February of 2023, and this leaker just let Canadians know that their democracy may be in serious trouble. So it begs a big question. Who was the leaker?
We don't know who leaked the information. The assumption is it's CSIS, but as they say, never assume because you make a you know what of you and me. That report, as I said, it's the right format for CSIS report. Once it's out of your hands, when you give it to a client, they're told, don't leak this to the Globe and Mail. Don't bring it home and line your birdcage. Don't give it to your kids for a school project. But once it's out of your hands, it's out of your hands.
Yeah.
So who decided to leak the information? That is still an outstanding question. So that, I think, is the lead up to this notion that somebody felt that this information, which was so valuable for so many years and seemed to have no effect on a succession of Canadian governments, of both political stripes, by the way, not just the Liberals, but the Conservatives, that this person had no recourse to say, okay, here's what we've been saying for years. I think Canadians should know this.
Adding to the mystery, the individual who leaked that report even wrote an anonymous op-ed for the Globe and Mail in March. They said that they were not motivated by politics or even an animus towards the Chinese government. Rather, it was to deepen the conversation amongst Canadians and to protect Canada from external threats to our society and democracy. The leaker even went on to say that, and I quote, "I do not believe that foreign interference dictated the present composition of our federal government, nor do I believe that any of our elected leaders is a traitor to our country. Nonetheless, the growing impact of foreign interference on our ability to enjoy a free and fair political process is undeniable," end quote. The insight here is pretty astounding. I mean, in order to make real democratic decisions, people need to know the lay of the land to understand the playing field. And listen, there has been tons of garbage political rhetoric out there from all sides of the aisle. Politicians will use this to spin and manipulate the narrative away from facts, but actually reading beyond all the rhetoric and getting to the truth of it, Canadians now know they are a target. There's no way around it. There's no way to bury your head in the sand. Canada is not this safe little island. We are the target of our adversaries, and ultimately, if they can control and manipulate what we do, they will try.
Now Canadians have no reason not to know that we have a foreign power, which is not an ally of Canada, by the way. And if you've been following anything China's doing internationally, it's not on our side. Under Xi Jinping, it's a totalitarian regime that incarcerates its own people in the millions. It doesn't care about autocracies abroad. It's probably supporting Russia and Ukraine. So let's wake up, smell the coffee, and call China for what it is. A state that is not bent on our best interests, is interfering in our democracy, is stealing our technology, and we should not be dealing with China as if it's just, you know, Fiji or Luxembourg. They're of a different mentality than we are unless we start pushing back against it with our allies, the Americans, the Brits, the Australians, the West Europeans. We're going to find ourselves in a much worse situation 5-10 years down the road.
It becomes a matter of awareness for the public, but also there's the ability to do the job, and Phil feels that Canada is falling behind.
My concern is that given lack of morale, given low resources, given the relative impossibility to repopulate those resources, you're being asked to do far too many things with far too many people, and you can't. Therefore, there are gaps, and you're going to miss things because you don't have the manpower to devote to doing investigations, recruiting sources, undertaking surveillance, doing warrants, all that kind of thing. And then when you work in that world, in law enforcement or national security, the old saying is that you're only as good as your last failure. You get things right, nobody really cares because nothing's happened, right? Get something wrong, miss something, where were you? And A, that's unfair because you're not all-knowing, all-seeing, and you've only got limited resources.
And to be very clear here, whether you think that the leak was wrong or right, it fundamentally doesn't matter. Canada's intelligence culture, due to lack of interest or funding or political will or just general apathy, it pushed someone to leak a classified report to the public, to risk jail time, to potentially commit espionage. And all they wanted to do was to show that Canada was not some impenetrable fortress on the hill and that our story isn't some fairy tale.
And we're going to get bit again. And, you know, so Chinese interference is not going away. Russian trolls aren't going away. Islamist terrorism aren't going away. The right wing's not going away. The far left is not going away. And if you can't look at it all with the appropriate amount of people, then it's inevitable that something bad's going to happen.
I guess it all boils down to the stories we tell versus the stories we choose or wish to ignore. I want to thank Phil Gursky for coming on this episode. Links to his work are in the show notes. And thank you to Sapper Labs for supporting this podcast. You can find them at www.sapperlabs.com. For more news, information, and content regarding OSINT, InfoSec, cybersecurity, and defense, make sure you visit our website, www.cloakanddagger.blog. And seeing as this is a brand new podcast, it really helps if you subscribe, rate, and review this show. You can tell your friends about it or share it on your socials. Go talk about it loudly in a public place. Whatever, it all helps. Thanks very much. I'm MJ Benias. This is Cloak and Dagger. I appreciate you being here, and we'll see you here next time.